Well, it's a pleasure for me to be here with you this morning. Whether it will be a pleasure for you to be with me obviously remains to be seen. My name is Michael Ramson, as you have heard, and I help direct something called the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, which is a centre based in Oxford. And what apologetics really is about is trying to take the questions that everybody has, regardless of their beliefs or convictions, seriously, and then from a Christian point of view, try to think through, well, what do Christians actually believe about that, and why? And obviously the question you've given me this morning is actually one of the most difficult and thorny questions you could possibly have given anybody. So thank you very much for that. Just to let you know, we don't bill by the hour, we bill by the challenge, and so at least this will be profitable for me, if not for you. It was the great philosopher Woody Allen who said, "How do you expect me to believe in God when only last week I got my tongue caught in the roller of my electric typewriter?" And that, if you like, puts this problem of suffering at its most banal. Right at the other end of that spectrum, you have the very personal questions. Well, why has this happened to me? And how do I understand this? And why am I caught up in something for which I seem to have no control and very little influence over at all, if at all? And so the ways in which we wrestle with this question are very varied. And one of the challenges of speaking to it is that a question like this raises an awful lot of philosophical questions, it raises a lot of theological questions, it raises a lot of existential questions, it raises a lot of personal questions just in terms of how we understand this. And this is why people don't simply write books on this, but write multi-volume series on this particular question. And since I'm a gracious and merciful man, I don't want to keep you here till tomorrow morning, what I'm going to do is try and sketch in outline and take a lot of leaps and therefore leave an awful lot of gaps, sort of like a picture of how I understand from a biblical point of view why it is, if there is a God who is loving by nature, that we see and live in the kind of world that we do. And then allow you to ask me questions to fill in where those gaps are, and maybe try to close some of those leaps. Because to go through this in a huge amount of detail would simply require way more time than we could possibly do here. So, having said all of that, let me just start off with not talking about suffering initially, but just talking about the problem of love. Because we often, when we have this kind of trouble, jump straight in at that end, but we just need to ask a couple of prior questions just to be clear what we're talking about. Because it was C.S. Lewis who said, when he wrote his book, The Problem of Pain, way back in the early 1940s, which is now still selling millions of copies, you know, all these decades on, he put it like this. He said, look, before I was a Christian, while I was an atheist, I believed in a cold, bleak, cruel universe. I didn't have a problem of pain. It just happened. There was no particular meaning, there was no particular purpose, there's no particular goodness. We all survive by praying on the weak, that's just the way it is, there's no problem. He says, my problem came, he says, when I began thinking about the person of Jesus Christ, and the more convinced I came that not only was he a good person and a loving person, but also God, now I had a problem that I didn't have before. Because now, if I'm moving and being drawn to believe in a God who is both good and loving, now I have a problem which I hadn't quite, you know, processed and hadn't come up to before. So there are so many different ways into this, and I don't have time to do all of them, but let's just take a few moments just to think about love. Now, the first thing to say, obviously, is one of the primary revelations biblically is the idea that God is love. Not just simply that he is loving, which describes an action or an attitude, but he is love in his nature. Now, that's a complicated statement to make. Because love is a quality that exists between two personal beings. Okay, you need two beings to experience and express love. I mean, I know some men get up in the morning, put gel in their hair, you know, look in the mirror, sigh deeply and go, I'm in love. But that's sad, all right? And that's not actually what love is. You do require this personal interaction. And so, because the problem of suffering isn't complex in and of itself, let's just introduce the Trinity into this as well, because that will make it much simpler. The statement, God is love, in his very nature, in his very existence, which is unique to the Christian faith and isn't found anywhere else, is a statement about how he exists. Three persons in one Godhead, three people in one thing, who live in a set of living, loving relationships. In other words, he is love. So whereas in other religious systems, God has to create in order to be able to love, right? Because God is cosmically lonely, he's a personal being on his own, he needs other personal beings in order to experience and express love, which would be an Islamic apologetic for creation. God creates other beings to make love possible. In other words, first of all, God creates life, and as a result of creating life, now you have love. The Christian faith sees it the other way around. God is love in and of himself. He doesn't create out of any kind of need that he has. And out of love proceeds then to create life, rather than creating life in order so then to have love. So it is, in one sense, a very uniquely Christian problem. Because the next question is, okay, well, if you've got this loving God, and that is his very nature, and that's how he exists, and that's how we should understand him, how then do we now understand the world in which we live, and why does it look like the way we are? Well, and that's a very good question, and I'm sure if you come to church here on Sunday, the vicar will explain it to you in detail. Let's just say one other thing about love. Most people would say that the idea of a loveless life or a lifeless love is terrifying to them. It's something that every poet and writer has struggled with, and some of you here would have had experience of. It can be a terrifying prospect and a horrible thing to go through. It is experiencing and expressing love in which we often find our deepest meaning. But what does it take for a loving God to create a loving world? What kind of world are we talking about? Now, let's supposing I were to say to you, look, I'm feeling very tired this morning. As a matter of fact, last night I had one of the worst nights of sleep I've had in ages. I think I had about 2 hours sleep, both through me waking up and my wife waking up with her. She's suffering from a bad back at the moment. So supposing I'm saying, you know what, I'm feeling rather lonely as I'm standing up here, and I'm feeling very tired, you know, and I really need to hear that someone loves me. My good friend Akhil is sitting back there, and so I ask Akhil to come and stand next to me on the stage, and he comes and stands up here, and I produce a gun out of my pocket and slowly fill every chamber with a bullet, and I pull back the firing pin and I say, Akhil, I really need to hear someone loves me right now, and I hold the gun to his head and say, Akhil, do you love me? Now, what is the most likely response? Well, the most likely response is, of course I love you, Michael. Maybe even with tears in his eyes, he will declare his undying love and affection for me. Now, imagine you go home later after this breakfast, and you see someone, and they say, where were you this morning? And you said, gosh, I went to church to hear someone talk about love and suffering. And you say, was it any good? You say, no, it was awful, but something very strange happened during the morning. This guy got up, walked onto the platform, broke down into tears, and declared his undying love and affection for the speaker. Now, does it or does it not make a difference whether they know a loaded gun was held to his head at the time? What does it mean to create a world in which love is capable of meaningful expression and experience? Have you ever heard people say things like, even if you were the last person in the world, I would love you? Have you ever heard that phrase? It's so meaningless. If you were the only person left in the world, they would have no option but to love you. I mean, what would be much more meaningful would be to say to somebody, if there were twice as many people in the world as there are right now, you'd still be the one for me. I mean, that's got some kind of meaning. It's significant. Love is a quality that exists between personal beings. Certain conditions have to be fulfilled, and one of those is exercising choice. And that's exactly the world that God has created. It is filled with choices. After God creates this loving God, in Genesis 1, creates a loving world, and he puts human beings in it, he tells them, you are free to go anywhere, and you're free to do whatever you want, apart from one thing. Now, sometimes people say, well, why would God create a world in which there is one thing that people can do which will mess everything up? And the answer is, it makes choice real. Henry Ford famously said the line, you can have any color car you want so long as it's black. And of course people laughed at that idea because he's saying, okay, you have whatever choices you want. The choices are black, black, or black. What do you want? And you go, I'll have the black one. And actually, this is an attributed comment. He never said that. The cars were unpainted, but that's a whole other story. It makes it real. And a real God created a real world in which love is capable of meaningful expression and experience. Now, that word free is troubling. Because when we think of free in our day and age, we think that means I can do whatever I want. I'm free. But freedom is not doing whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want to. That is anarchy. And places of the world where anarchy has broken out are not marked by an increase in the amount of freedom they experience, but by the loss of it. There are some countries I travel to every year which are literally in anarchy. You cannot walk down the street without fear of being shot or blown up. Those societies which have cast off all forms of moral restraint are not experiencing a growth of freedom. They've experienced the loss of it. That's why the day after the Declaration of American Independence was signed, which is obviously a very tragic document, one of the signatures to that declaration, the day after, was giving a speech in which he said, "Once a nation is equally poised, it must either preserve its virtue or lose its liberty. Once a nation is equally poised, you either have to preserve your virtue or lose your liberty." Freedom isn't doing whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want to. That is anarchy. Freedom is a moral concept. It only exists within a moral framework. When you remove that moral framework, which when we do and sometimes jettison, we think, well, that means I'm going to be more free. The irony is we become less free. And so the biblical understanding is a loving God does create a loving world, and he gives it a moral framework to protect and preserve both the nature and quality of love and to provide a framework within which we can operate. Now, here is where, from a biblical picture, things start to go wrong. Because rather than embrace that for what it is and welcome it into our lives, we decided we'll be both better off without God and without his law. But the problem is in one important sense, you cannot break God's law. Trying to break God's moral law is impossible. Imagine you want to break the law of gravity. So what you do is you climb to the top of this rather magnificent building you have. Okay, you put a red cape around your neck, a big S on your chest, and a pair of red underpants on the outside of everything else you're wearing. And you throw yourself from the top of the building in order to break the law of gravity. What will you break? You will break yourself while proving the law in the process. In that sense, it is impossible to break God's moral law. We simply end up breaking ourselves while proving it in the process. It's very interesting. When one of the other questions I often get asked to speak about is along the lines of, isn't God schizophrenic? In the Old Testament, you've got this very angry God, and then in the New Testament, you've got this very loving God, and the two seem to be incompatible. How do you understand that? Now, some of that's got to do with the way in which we just simply read things, but let me just read to you just a few verses. This is from the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, and just listen to what this is saying. And as I read it, ask yourself this question. What tone of voice do you think these words are spoken in? Okay, so this is God speaking through the prophet Isaiah, and this is what he says. "Woe to the sinful nation, a people whose guilt is great, a brood of evildoers, children given to corruption, forsaken the Lord, and you have spurned the Holy One of Israel, and you have turned your backs on him. Why should you be beaten anymore? Why do you persist in rebellion? Your whole head is injured, your whole heart afflicted. From the sole of your foot to the top of your head, there is no soundness in you, only wounds and welts and open sores, and not cleansed or bandaged or soothed with oil. Your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire," and it goes on and on and on. Now, what did you hear? Now, it's interesting that most people, when they read this, their response is, well, this sounds like someone who's very angry. Now, I'm not sure that's the correct tone. I don't know if you noticed the questions that I read out. Now, you may notice that sometimes parents ask their children stupid questions. You may have noticed that, like, "Do you want a smack?" You know, as if, you know, any child would go, yeah, I'm going to need two, because I've been naughty now, but I'm going to be naughty again in the afternoon, so, you know, I'll just take them both up front. Now, those are what a stupid question to ask. Now, in the middle of this passage, there appear to be two questions, which initially appear foolish, but if you think about them, aren't at all. God says to them, "Why do you want to be beaten anymore? Why persist in your rebellion?" Whenever you break God's law, people get hurt. Has anyone ever lied to you? Have you ever been stabbed in the back by a friend? Betrayed? Did it hurt? God is here looking at a group of people and saying to them, "Why persist in your rebellion? Why do you want to be beaten? Look at you. From the bottom of your feet to the top of your head, you are covered in damage. And no one is there to soothe you, to bandage you. And it's not just affecting you, it's affecting your cities, it's affecting your country. One of the leading professors of economic thought at the University of Oxford has published some fascinating research, which is actually exceedingly well known in the field of economics, and presents one of the greatest single economic questions in the field of the sociology of economics that we've had for the last couple of decades. When I was initially taught economics many years ago, we were basically told that people were rational. And you have a rational consumer who acts in a rational way, and you can get a pricing mechanism out of it. The trouble is all of our research for the last 30 years proves one thing conclusively. We consistently make self-defeating choices. We seem to consistently act in a way which will harm us and potentially harm other people even when we're aware of the consequences. Why? Why is that the case? God here is appealing to a group of people and saying, look at the choices you are making. And look at what it entails. So the biblical understanding is a loving God does create a loving world, and he puts us in it. He gives it a moral framework to protect and preserve that quality and character of love. But by rejecting him and breaking the law, we have broken lives. And not only do we have broken lives, it affects us personally. We live in a broken world because it affects everybody else and everything around us. A couple of weeks ago, I was contacted by a BBC TV producer saying, look, we want to produce a documentary about the Philippines in light of the disaster that's hit. Because the Philippines is one of the most religious countries in the world. Everyone's praying to God, and look at the huge disaster that's befallen them. And we would like to talk to people like you and interview you to have your commentary on what's just happened. And so I said, well, what are you looking for in the program? We went backwards and forwards. And then I said, can I ask you a question? And she said, that's fine. I said, I was listening to a Radio 4 program yesterday. I said, you had the editor of The Guardian, one of the editors of BBC News, and whoever the host was for that particular program, having a studio debate. And the question you were debating was this. The Guardian had reported the day before that the hurricane in the Philippines and all the disaster that fell could be attributable to human action through global warming. In other words, the way we're destroying our environment and what we're doing to our environment has catastrophic consequences, and we can see it evidenced there. And the debate you were having was, is this responsible reporting? Is it responsible reporting for someone to write such an editorial, and should it have been given national time on BBC Radio? Was it responsible? I said, and everybody in the studio said, absolutely, this was responsible reporting. This is an important story. The message has to get out there, and we should say it. I said, here's my question for you. Why is it okay for the BBC to say that human action can have disastrous consequences for our environment, and that's responsible reporting? But if I were to say to you as a Christian that human beings do something wrong, we call it sin, and it has disastrous consequences for our environment, it can't be taken seriously. And she went silent for about 5 seconds at the end of the phone, and then she said, I think you've just given me my story. Because the biblical understanding is not only have we broken God's law and we lead broken lives, but we live in a broken world. Everything around us has been affected, and things are not the way they are now, the way they were originally. Things have gone wrong. And we see the evidence of it all around us, everywhere we go. Now, the story doesn't stop there, because our understanding also is from God's reaction, is that this has broken God's heart. He doesn't look on in a disinterested way. In Isaiah, he comes and pleads with people and says, why on earth do you want to live this way? And a few verses later, in the same chapter, he says to the same group of people, come now, let us reason together. Though your sins are like scarlet, they can be made as white as snow. And he's pleading with them. Don't continue in this way. It is self-destructive. It's destructive for your family. It's destructive for your nation. It's destructive for everything around you. Don't go that way. And he is pleading with them. Jesus looked over Jerusalem and he wept. God incarnate cries over the kinds of things that we do. Now, this then raises a very important question, however. And I don't have time to deal with it in its entirety, but it goes something like this. Okay, Michael, let's just assume everything you said is true, just for argument's sake. Loving God creates a loving world, endows it with love, gives it a moral framework to protect and preserve the nature of that love and to make it real. And in violation of it, we damage ourselves, we damage people around us, and we live in a damaged world. Okay, let's assume that's true. Was it worth it? Given the amount of suffering we go through, the pain we experience, the anguish, the loss, everything else, was it worth it? Wouldn't it have been better for God not to have created in the first place if that was going to be the outcome? Now, that's a very good question. And one day, I'm sure someone will come up with a very good answer. C.S. Lewis said, "I struggle with this question, but not for the reason you may think." He says, "Because I'm trying to understand what the question means. When someone says, it would be better for me not to exist, what does that mean? First of all, what does the word better mean? When you say one thing is better than another thing, so if I were to say, look, you know, your Bentley GT is a better car than my Volkswagen Golf, there's a set of criteria that we could apply to that statement to decide which one is better or not. Does that make sense? And according to the criteria we apply, he says, what criteria do you apply to judge existence and non-existence? What's the criteria you're using? He says, number two, why is the non-existent you more happy at not existing than the existent you? In what sense, for me, what does that word me mean when it's non-existent? So Lewis said, this, I understand the force of this question, but it seems a very problematic question to raise in a meaningful way. What are we actually talking about? What is the comparison that we can legitimately make, and why is the non-existent you suddenly more happy and satisfied as a result of it? He says, I can't get my heart around it. However, I think that there is some kind of insight given, and I admit that it's only just a glimpse, a hint, in this. The way we determine the value of something economically is the price you're prepared to pay for it. Okay? Which is why, you know, a starving man in the desert has no demand for food or water if he has no money to pay for it. I mean, this is my wedding ring. It's gold, or well, the person who sold it to me assured me it was gold. As someone once said, this is a small band of metal that cuts off your circulation. Now, if no one wanted gold and no one was prepared to pay for it, what worth would this have? Economically, no one's prepared to pay for gold, and the answer is zero. Everything's rare, even plastic is rare, it's not an infinite resource. Things have value because we're prepared to pay for it. The way we determine things in terms of value economically is through that mechanism. The price that God was prepared to pay in order to rescue a world that he created that turned its back on him was the highest possible price he could have paid. It's not just the fact that a loving God created a loving world, gave it freedom, which we then broke, and broke his law, broke our lives, and live in a broken world, and this broke his heart. On the night before Jesus Christ went to the cross, he picked up a loaf of bread, broke it, and said, "This is my body, broken for you." The price that God was prepared to pay to rescue and redeem a broken world was the highest possible price he could have paid. God himself came into this world in the person of Christ, and when he went on the cross, he took on all of the brokenness in this world and all of the consequences and penalty that it deserves onto himself, and was prepared to give himself in order to rescue it. Let's suppose at the end of this day you walk away and you think, I'll be very happy never to hear from Michael Ramson again. And you go back home and they say, what happened? You say, it was terrible. Complete waste of time. Never should have gone. And they say, who was speaking? And they say, and you say, a guy called Michael Ramson. And they look at you and they say, tall, dark, good looking. And you say, yeah, I sort of understand what you're saying. And they say, there's something you don't know about him. You say, what's that? They say, remember 10 years ago when you were in a coma in hospital and you needed a kidney transplant and you were about to die. You had days left. Michael was visiting the area and heard about what's happening and offered himself up to have a blood test, and it just so happened he was a perfect match for you. And he insisted on anonymity. You never knew about it, but he gave his kidney. And that's the reason why you're alive today. Now, even up until that point, you had no interest in meeting me, and maybe even distrusted me, or maybe even hated me. On receiving that information, does it change the way you feel about me? And the answer is, I would be very surprised if you didn't try to track down my email or get hold of my phone number and drop me a short line to say, Michael, I never knew you did this for me. I'd just like to say thank you. God has done an awful lot more for us than just simply give us a kidney. The cross and resurrection of Christ speak into the problem of suffering in two ways. Because strictly speaking, from a philosophical angle, there are two aspects to this problem. There's the problem of evil, which we call a moral problem. That makes sense. I do something bad against you. Why should that happen? And then the problem of suffering, physical pain and death. Okay? And actually, that strictly speaking, they're two separate problems philosophically. And so when we talk about the problem of suffering and evil before God, we're normally raising two questions. There's a lot of injustice in this world. Bad things, bad people are getting away with doing bad things to people all over the place. How is that possibly fair? Well, the cross speaks into that issue directly because what it promises is that there will be a day of judgment. Have you ever noticed how... Look, let's suppose, again, you're visiting here. You go back to your car. It's in the car park. You're about to put the key in and you step back and someone has taken a key and scratched your car all the way up and down several times. Brand new. You know, whatever it may be. Aston Martin Vanquish S. There it is, beautiful, gleaming metallic, and it is now scratched and dented, the full width of the car. Don't you feel like looking up to God and saying, is this, I don't believe in you, I come to this place, I listen to one of your guys speaking on your behalf, he bores me to tears, and I come back and this is how you repay me? I mean, there's a sense of injustice about it, isn't there? I mean, what would you do, even if you live next to the chief of police, okay, the chief constable? Would you go, and he's your next door neighbor, would you go to his house, knock on the door and say, I want you to cancel all police leave until you find the person? I mean, that's what you feel like, but that's not going to happen, is it? But let's suppose you're standing there, you're looking at the car, you've got your keys in your hand, and you look around and you suddenly notice the church has installed CCTV cameras everywhere around this building. So you come back in, you find someone, you say, do you come here? Yes. Look, there are some CCTV cameras in the car park, are they on? And they say, yes. They say, do you know where it's been recorded? And they take you and they say, is there any way I could get a recording from camera number 8? And they take a DVD and they burn a copy. You go home and you put it into your DVD player. You press play and sure enough, there is the car. And not only do you see the person who scratched your car, you recognize them. It's your next door neighbor who has hated you from the day you moved in. No real explanation, nothing whatever. You can't explain it. They never liked you. Now what do you do? Imagine inviting them around for a cup of tea the next day. You give them a cup of tea, piece of cake, and you say, oh, by the way, there's a little video I'd like to show you. And you press play on the remote. How do you feel now? And the answer is, pretty good. Imagine you're the guy who did the vandalism. You think you got away with it. Now the sucker is giving you tea and cake in his front room. You're sitting there as smug as anything, and he hits play. Now how do you feel? Have you ever noticed when we get caught doing something wrong, we normally feel angry about it? It's very common, isn't it? The way we react emotionally to the prospect of judgment tells you what side of the law you're on. If you're being wronged, you cry for justice. If you're the person who's been doing the wronging, we live in fear of it. And sometimes we even feel angry about it. The idea that there will be a day of judgment, if it makes us feel angry, tells us something about what we feel, what side of the law we're on vis-a-vis God. And if we have experienced extreme injustice in our life, the idea that there will be a final judgment in which no one gets away with anything speaks peace. Because they haven't got away with it. It will be righted. The resurrection, which is also central to the Christian faith, speaks directly into the physical side of it. We will all die, some sooner than others. You know, someone once said, in life, your body is the baggage you carry, and the more excess of the baggage, the shorter the trip. Well, on that basis, I might, you know, only have a couple of decades left. But I always think of myself as an environmental benefactor, because as a carbon-based life form, the bigger I am, the more carbon I'm storing in my body, and given the environmental challenges we have, I feel like I'm helping out the environment. But we will all pass away. What do you say to someone who's just lost a young child? And part of the answer to that from a Christian understanding is this isn't the only world that there is. There is a world to come. C.S. Lewis said, like the life we lead now is like an introduction page to a novel that has an infinite number of chapters after it, every one better than the one before. This is the world we live in, but it's not the world we live for. And there is a promise of something to come. So the reassurance and the hope that the Christians have in light of both evil and suffering are met and seen both through the cross and the resurrection, and also at the same time highlight the hope that we have. It's because of this sense that not only is God's heart broken over what he sees, but he has intervened to make it personally possible for us to now to begin some element of reconciliation within our own life. And the prospect of judgment, because as I said, some suffering that you and I suffer has nothing to do with us. It's not our fault. If you live in a broken world, some things will happen to you. It's not our fault at all. But righteousness will be done. That hope is actually then made possible. Because God himself steps into it. And it's that prospect of hope and the fact this isn't simply the only world that there is that helps us draw a line to see something much bigger. The way we tell whether a story is happy or sad is where you draw the line. So if I were to tell you a story to say, you know, someone came into the world full of life and joy, well, that's a good story if we draw the line there. If they then experience incredible brokenness and pain and we draw the line there, now it's a tragedy. If having gone through that, they find true life and peace and family, and we draw the line there and we stop it, it's now a happy story. Can you see? Any story, depending where you draw the line, will depend on whether it's happy or sad, ultimately. If the line is going to be drawn, not simply in this world, but in eternity, it is through that perspective you then begin to process everything else. Let me just finish with a few words from a hymn. Annie Johnston Flint wrote many hymns. She came into this world and sadly was orphaned at a very young age. She was raised by her grandparents, who both died when she was 18. While she was at university studying, she developed arthritis in its most crippling form and spent the rest of her life in bed. Being bedridden, she developed bed sores. And the person who wrote a book who tells her story called The Making of the Beautiful records how when he went to visit her, she had 8 pillows under her back and her legs to try to alleviate the pain of the bed sores that had set in. She then developed cancer and also became incontinent. So here is this lady, cancer-ridden, in bed, incontinent. She wrote many hymns. Here's just one of them. He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To addeth affliction, he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials is multiplied peace. When we reach the end of our human endurance, when our strength has failed and the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving has only begun. His love has no limit, his grace has no measure, his power has no boundaries known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. The ultimate hope that we find in this world through the Christian faith is not the fact that we are delivered from pain and suffering, but that in the midst of the pain and the suffering we go through, God reaches out to us with an outstretched hand, invites us to put our hand in his, to give us strength and grace to deal with the situation we face now and the hope of something else to come. And in one sense, that, as far as I can do it, from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation, is like a biblical overview of why we have a God of love and a world of suffering. So thank you very much for listening to me. I hope it was worthwhile. Now, I realize I have made some massive jumps. I've made some huge logical leaps. And I've also left an awful lot out of this, which is very, very legitimate. And so you will have the opportunity now to ask me questions. So someone's got a microphone, and they're going to come up to you to take in some questions. If you could just think of whatever question you'd like to ask, write it on a £50 note, hand it to the guy with the microphone, He will bring it up to the front and we'll do our best to answer some of them.
Hello, Michael. Thank you very much for that. Just one question that arose in my mind when you were talking about natural disasters, right, and you mentioned the Philippines, and it might be attributable to man's action in global warming. But surely there are many natural disasters that are nothing to do with us.
Right, yes. That is absolutely true as well. One of the great challenges that we have in this area is that it is much more complex at times than anything that simple. One of my colleagues I know who's spoken at one of these breakfasts before, called John Lennox, when he was speaking in New Zealand just after the earthquake that hit there, gave a talk which was simply called Why? It's available online. You can access it through our website if you'd like to listen to it. Where he was speaking to parents who had lost their children in that disaster. And one of the things he just very tentatively mentions is, look, we live in a much more complicated world than we first understood. In a book published by the equivalent of the head of the Royal Academy of Sciences, but in the US, where obviously there is no Royal Academy because they got rid of royalty, another tragic mistake. He wrote a book called Rare Earth, in which he says, look, plate tectonics is the reason why we have a breathable atmosphere. Now, the question then comes, and we ask these questions all the time. Okay, yes, but couldn't it have been done some other way? Can't we have a breathable atmosphere in the absence of plate tectonics? Isn't it possible to have a sun that provides light but that doesn't burn? So then people wouldn't be killed through. And the simple answer to that is, I don't know. It's very difficult to raise and answer that kind of question, because what would it actually look like? And it's very complex then at that point to come up with an alternative, and just say, well, this would be better. Even just recently, and this isn't, I'm not, by the way, alluding to an argument from design, I just want to just talk about complexity. I mean, I can remember 6 years ago, sitting in an Oxford University lecture, listening to a senior professor of biology explain why the eye was a very bad design because of a particular element of it, poorly designed. 3 years later, I'm reading another research paper by another academic at Oxford saying, you know what, for ages we thought this was bad design, we've suddenly realized that without this, it simply wouldn't work. This is a vital feature, and it's probably, maybe, possibly the best solution to this particular problem. So one of the complications that we have when looking into that kind of scenario is, well, we can make our best judgment at the time, this doesn't look good, maybe we can do that. Sometimes what we find is that the solution we propose causes more problems than we thought, and then it causes you to reevaluate the problem in the first place. So absolutely, there is some sense in which we live with a level of complexity in our world, which means that, which is why I think trying to give an exhaustive answer to this question is impossible, as far as I know from a human perspective. I think we can say something meaningful, and I think we can say something that maybe gives a big picture to make sense. But inevitably, I think there are going to be areas which are going to feel much more mysterious to us, and will be much harder to come up with something in any kind of fixed way, partly because our understanding is shifting the whole time. And on both of those debates I've just mentioned, I have no doubt in 10 years' time, other research will come out to light which will contradict what we have, and maybe 10 years after that, back the other way, which is why I wouldn't want to hang too much on it. But yeah, it's a great question.
Thank you very much for being here, Michael. Please make sure Paul gives you the 50 quid I just
gave you. Oh, yeah, I will.
You made the point that humanity has brought suffering upon itself by breaking God's moral law, and I absolutely accept that. Where does Satan enter into this? Where does evil enter into the suffering?
Okay, that's a very good... You know, as I was running through this, I was debating about whether to put this in or out. So thanks for raising the questions. I'll put it back in. Again, it was one of Lewis's images he picked up very strongly. And if you're interested in exploring this a little bit more, just after the tsunami, an editorial was written in the Wall Street Journal called The Doors of the Sea, which was written by an Orthodox priest called David Bintley Hart in response to the tsunami. And it got such an amazingly positive review The editor of the journal said, you should write a book. And he wrote a book, it's only about 80 or 90 pages long, that also develops this particular theme. But the way Lewis put it was, he said, look, and you have to remember, obviously, he wrote his Problem of Pain during the Second World War. Right? That's when that book was crafted. He said, let's suppose when you go into a great European city and you see a bombed-out cathedral. He said, you can look at the ruin and you can close your eyes and you can imagine this glorious, beautiful structure. He said, and then you can open your eyes again and look at the devastation in front of you. And you would naturally conclude some enemy has come here and done this. So it's not just the fact that we live in a world where maybe, certainly, we suffer things which are not our fault directly, okay, because we can't draw straight lines. We also live in a universe, the Bible tells us, in which we're not the only intelligent, active beings in it. Now, again, it's very interesting how people respond to that kind of statement differently. If I was on Radio 4 talking about, is there intelligent life in the universe on other planets? And I said, no, we're the only intelligent life form in this universe. There are a large number of academics, I know at Oxford and everywhere else, who would laugh me out of the room and say, don't be stupid. That is a ridiculous view to take. You're most certainly wrong. So if I say it from a scientific perspective, very acceptable. If I say again as a Christian, we're not the only intelligent life forms in this world, all of a sudden they think, gosh, he's a bit strange. So it is, I think, a very important aspect. Are we involved in a world in which there is also spiritual struggle and battle? Let me just tell the story because I find it quite amusing. I work with a couple called Frog and Amy. He's also a Church of England vicar. And when they bought a house in Oxford to live in, they got to know their next-door neighbour very well. And after a couple of weeks, their next-door neighbours came round to them. He was a physicist, I think, theoretical physicist, and she taught something else. I can't remember what it was. Sociology and something, I think, at the university. And they came round and they said, you know, when we heard that a Church of England vicar had bought the house next to us, we were so upset by it, we thought about moving. Because they are such convinced atheists. They said, the last person we wanted living next to us was some religious nutcase. And then we just thought, we can't, we've poured too much money into the house, it's just too expensive to buy and sell and move somewhere else, and we were so... She says, and we are so surprised how much we like you. So you seem such nice people. So they got knowing each other, and their gardens were very narrow, and they had fences which were only about 4 foot high, little, you know, because, you know, otherwise you have big fences, there'd be no grass, you'd just kill everything. So they get... You know, if you're in your back garden, you just get talking to everybody. And so they got to know them that way. And after a few more weeks, this couple came around and sat in their room and they said, can you help us? I said, we've lived in our house for 8 years and we love our house, but almost every night we both wake up in a cold sweat in our home and we're terrified. We feel like there's some kind of evil presence there. And we're wondering, as a Church of England vicar, you know, if you could maybe come around and pray in our house. So they go around and they pray in their house and they pray with this couple. And the next morning, the lady comes and rings the doorbell, 8 a.m., and says, last night was the first peaceful sleep we had in our house in ages. Now, here's the irony. They're both atheists. He's a theoretical physicist. They're thinking of moving the house out of the house because they don't want some religious nutcase living next door. And yet, that's the kind of issue ultimately that they were wrestling with. So... I don't want to put too much weight on that. The Bible does talk about the fact that we're involved in a struggle and that there's more to this world than we just simply see. So it's definitely a part of it, but it's not an exhaustive part of it. Gosh, these are great questions. What time are we finishing? I know I said I'd sort of finish around 9:15, so if we take one more and then...
Yeah,
One or two more. By the way, when everyone finishes, I know some people have to leave. I'm happy to stay around. Ooh, let me just say one thing, just as we're moving into this last question. You will realize that there are a lot of gaps in what I've said. And if you're listening carefully, you're thinking, I can think of maybe 10 other things I'd like to say and other objections, counterpoints. How does that make sense? The church here is running a course called Christianity Explored. And there is information about it on your tables. And that is an opportunity to come along. to one of those groups that meet at different times. If you're in the evening group, then certainly with a meal and then over coffee afterwards, to actually go through a structured sort of discussion so that the conversation isn't jumping around all over the place. And if you're interested in that, by all means, either speak with whoever brought you here or with the guy in the check shirt standing there with the microphone, and they will be able to tell you what to do next. But go on, let's just take another question then.
Thank you, Michael. Now, a couple of verses came up in my mind, and I tracked them down to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 13, 1 to 5. Now, were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Jesus answered, "Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the Tower in Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish." And my question is Jesus oversimplifying things or is he complicating?
I think these verses are astounding. Let's just deal with, if we went into the philosophy faculty at Oxford University right now and we said problem of pain and God, every student would say there are the two aspects to this problem, the physical side, okay, which has to be answered physically, and then the moral side, which has to be dealt with a moral solution. And here you'll notice Jesus addresses both. Okay? He talks about those on whom the Tower of Siloam fell, that's the problem of physical suffering and death, and then those whom Pilate killed and mingled with their blood with, that's the problem of moral evil. So he draws both. Then he then says, which is very important, you can't draw simple straight lines between what they suffered, and their own personal actions. Which is very important. It underscores this thing I said about the fact that we all encounter suffering and evil in this world, some of which isn't our fault. So look, if I get in my car, having been drinking all night the night before, reverse out of my house and run over your four-year-old, has the four-year-old done anything to deserve it? And the answer is no. Can we draw a straight line between some bad thing they did the day before and their death? No. Now, we may be able to draw, in that case, some kind of wiggly lines between my own sinful action, do you know what I mean? Getting drunk the night before, and what happened. We can definitely do that. And if I die of liver sclerosis of the liver, and I'm taken to drinking a bottle of vodka every night before going to bed, then we can certainly draw much stronger lines between the physical pain I'm going through and my action. But notice what Jesus says here, because this is actually a response actually to a problem that Richard Dawkins highlighted, which I almost did for you this morning. I almost read to you a long article by Richard Dawkins, where he basically says, well, look, all the bad stuff that happens in this world is one big payback for sin. And that's what Christians have you believe. So if you're suffering, God is now paying you back. It's like the Christian equivalent of karma. But the problem is Christians don't believe in karma. And here Jesus is introducing another level of nuance to say, you can't draw straight lines that way. He says, were they worse sinners than you? The ones whom the top of, were they particularly bad, so God singled them out and splat? The answer is no. And those who suffered moral evil when Pilate came and killed them and then mingled their blood with the blood of the sacrifice, were they worse than you? And the answer is no. So the annoying thing that annoys me when people make statements like that, especially when they have chairs at Oxford, is, gosh, I just wish you would read a little bit more, because that wouldn't be a classical Christian position at all, and certainly not a biblical one, to be able to do it quite like that. So I think he's adding in another layer of sufficiency. There's one other thing that he does too, which you may notice. He doesn't say that they're not sinners at all. So we're all in the same boat. And we're all heading to the same destination. But there is a way out. I can remember talking with someone in India once, and they said to me, look, Michael, trouble with you Christians is you think Jesus is just the only way to go. But, if you want to come into Bombay, you know, you can come in on the number 13 bus from the south, or you can come in from the number 26 bus from the east, or you can come down from the number 39 bus from the north, and we're all on different buses and we're all going to the same destination. And that's what you need to understand. And I smiled and I listened to them say this. I said, can I ask you a question? And they said, fine. I said, when you've done your shopping and you want to go home, will you take the number 13 bus that you're on now? Or will you take the number 26 bus that will take you west? Or the number 39 that will take you north? And they looked at me and I said, the question I'm asking you is it the case that we all come from different starting points and we're moving towards one place? Or do we find ourselves with a common starting point? We may be moving to one of two different destinations. And the question is, which way will this ticket take you? And what Jesus is saying here is, look, this path will take you there. But if you repent, which literally means to change your mind and change direction, if you stop going that way, but you turn around and you go the opposite way, the implication is you'll be somewhere else. And so I think what Jesus is doing here is actually quite sophisticated and remarkably interesting. I mean, it may be a good note on which to finish. Can I just say one other thing? And then I say I'm very happy to hang around and talk to you afterwards personally if you'd like me to. Just after the tsunami, I was asked by the Oxford Union if I would come and give a talk on God and the tsunami. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Oxford Union. It's a very old debating society in Europe, and they take pride in being rude to their guests sometimes. So students will sometimes run a book, and they'll invite the Dalai Lama to speak, and the question is who can ask him the rudest question. So it's a kind of invitation that you both like and also dread simultaneously. And I wrote back and I said, look, I will come, but I'm not happy with the title. Hundreds of thousands of people have just died, and it feels like we're going to pull a crowd on the basis of that, and I'm just not personally comfortable with that. Can I talk on God and suffering? And I promise you, in the context of that, I'll talk about the tsunami. But can we just leave it out of the title? And they agreed. So we went ahead, and the place was packed. And there was one point I was debating about, gosh, should I put this in and out, in or out of my talk? And I put it in, and then I took it out. And then I put it back in, and I took it out. And I don't know if any of you have had to give a presentation, you're really struggling, should I put this in or out? And in the end, I just had it with a big red bracket around it and a question mark next to it, thinking, will I say this or not? Anyway, the flow of the talk went in such a way I thought, actually, I think I will say this. And so my concluding remark there was this. I said, look, you may say to me, okay, Michael, maybe there is a biblical picture that makes sense of all of this and maybe even provides hope at the end of it. I said, let's supposing you hear all of that. You may then say to me, but Michael, even knowing that, even given that, don't you struggle? When you see something this big with this much damage, doesn't it cause you to question and doubt God? Now, what I said was, look, I would doubt God if I saw things happen in this world that he said wouldn't happen. If Jesus said, look, there are some things in this world that will not happen, and then they happened, I would doubt whether he was God for very simple reasons. But when I see things happen in this world that Jesus promised would happen, they don't cause me to doubt him, but they do cause me to question, what on earth does all of this mean? In Luke 21, a bit later after this incident you just read, Jesus said there would come a time when the nations would be appalled at the roaring and tossing of the sea. Now, normally captains of boats are appalled at the roaring and tossing of the sea, not nations in the plural. I said, so when I see things happen in this world that Jesus said would happen, it doesn't cause me to doubt him, but it does cause me to question, what does this mean? Is there a bigger picture? Let me really recommend the Christianity Explored program to you. I mean, I know some of you here are Christians. Some of you here may be new Christians. It's not no bad actually thing to actually go through something like that. It can be very helpful. Some of you may just have questions. Some of you may be very skeptical. The purpose of a breakfast like this and Christianity Explored is to raise the question, maybe the person of Christ and the Bible has more to say than we think it might do. Maybe there is more here and more insight here than we may initially have given it credit for. And it presents a wonderful opportunity to be able to find out and ask that question, well, what does it say? Is there some insight here that really does make sense of this world in which we see, as well as simply providing, as well as providing hope within it? Well, you've listened very, very well. You've been very, very generous and gracious with your time. Thank you for having me. If you have a headache, a couple of aspirin will take care of it. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy the rest of the time with your friends. Thank you very much.